Revolutionary talk for revolutionary times. Promoting peace, liberty, and prosperity around the clock. LibertyTalk.fm.
Welcome to Living the Solution with Dr. Elena George. Today we have an important show. We've spoken about education in the past, and we have talked about all the problems out there. And I was just telling our guests that I don't know how parents do it these days, because it was just simple. When I went to school, you went to school, you learned. There was nothing else that you had to worry about or navigate. And it was about learning. I don't think that's the case anymore. In every state right now, we're seeing parents at odds with their school boards, children not learning what they're supposed to. And I mean, I guess we'll talk about it too, but I mean, we learned about cursive, we learned a gamut of things that we could use, critical thinking being one of them. I'm not sure that's still the case. And so I wanted to speak with someone who can tell us about choices, because it seems if you turn on TV, you only have one option. Either you keep your child in a situation that you may not be happy with, or you have to take on the burden yourself, which is kind of hard if you're a working parent. So today we wanted to speak with Ms. Carrie McDonald. She's a senior education fellow at the Foundation for Economic Education and the host of the weekly Liberated podcast. She's also the author of Unschooled, Raising Curious, Well-Educated Children Outside the Conventional Classroom. She's an adjunct scholar at the Cato Institute, education policy fellow at State Policy Network, and a regular Forbes contributor. Her research interests include homeschooling and schooling alternatives, self-directed learning, education entrepreneurship, parent empowerment, school choice, and family and child policy. Her articles are myriad, and they include The Wall Street Journal, Newsweek, NPR, Education Next, Reason Magazine, Washington Examiner, City Journal, Entrepreneur, and the Journal of School Choice, among others. She has a master's degree in education policy from Harvard University and a bachelor's degree in economics from Bowdoin College. She lives in Massachusetts with her family, and I know, Ms. McDonald, how busy you are, so I really, really appreciate you joining me today.
Oh, I'm glad to be back with you, Dr. George. Thanks for having me.
Oh, it's a pleasure. You know, last time we spoke, you gave a real eye-opening presentation, really, of what's out there for parents, and it's been so adversarial over the past year. I just wanted to once again revisit everything that you do, because I think knowledge is power. And if you know something, then you can choose what's best for you and your family. So since I've last spoken with you, what's the climate like? I mean, I'm seeing it from a television standpoint, but you're on the front lines. What is it like, in your opinion, for parents now who are not necessarily happy with the direction of their child's education?
Well, I think parents now have more options than ever. I mean, we're in this transformational moment in K-12 U.S. education, where parents are empowered in ways that they never were previously. And that's really a result of the COVID lockdowns and specifically remote schooling, when children's classrooms came into family homes and parents got a close-up look, in many cases for the first time, of what was actually happening in their children's classrooms, what their children were learning or were not learning. And a lot of what parents saw, they didn't like. And then this prolonged remote schooling enabled families to start thinking about taking matters into their own hands. Many started to consider homeschooling because, of course, they were home with their kids anyway. And they thought, well, what does that look like? And then increasingly, they discovered that it's, as you mentioned, it's not all or nothing. It's not homeschooling or sending your child to conventional school. There's a lot of room in between and a lot of education, innovation, and entrepreneurship occurring that I think parents really weren't aware of before. I mean, some of these trends were occurring in the decade before 2020, but they weren't something that was really apparent to a lot of families until, again, the school closures really brought that front and center. And what we saw during 2020 and 2021, not only were skyrocketing rates of homeschooling doubling from in 2020 alone and tripling from pre-pandemic rates, and then remaining elevated even in 2021 and to today, while schools are back to normal. So parents really realizing that that they can take matters in their own hands, but also realizing that they do have all of these other choices. We saw in 2020 and 2021 the rise of what was called pandemic pods, which were these kind of mixed age, small learning communities, typically in family homes where parents would either hire an educator or take turns facilitating a curriculum. And that was very much like the micro schools that were, again, emerging prior to 2020, and that it's just taken off over the past couple of years. And micro schools really are that in between homeschooling and conventional schooling, where families can either go part-time or full-time 5 days a week as a full-time schooling alternative, but they tend to be smaller, much more nurturing, much more personalized, mastery-based curriculum. They're really what parents, I think, are looking for, and there's just so many more options across the country.
Well, the first thing that comes to my mind is, what happened? Is there pushback from the standard educational system? It's very monolithic. It's very power-oriented. How are they taking this, with parents taking their power back?
Well, I think that so far, so good, right? I mean, I think families are voting with their feet. Certainly, you talked about a lot of the strife in school board meetings and so on. So there is this combination of voice and exit of families speaking out against what they don't like in schools and trying to push for change there. But increasingly, families are just fleeing their assigned district school for some of these other options. And there's really not much that, you know, school districts can do about that. I mean, some, interestingly enough, are trying to be a little bit more competitive and have their own micro schools within a school district. And some districts are forming these private public partnerships with national micro school networks like Prenda Learning, which creates these kind of small micro schools and learning pods so that they become tuition free, but are typically associated with a school district or some other kind of state department of education, as the cases in New Hampshire that used this COVID relief money to provide these Prenda pods to families who wanted a micro school environment but couldn't afford to pay out of pocket. So, you know, I think we're seeing those creative strategies. But for the most part, you know, micro schools are typically a fraction of the cost of conventional private schools, often a quarter or a fifth of the cost even of a typical private school in a given area. So they're generally much more accessible to more families just by nature of their cost. And they also, in many states, are being covered by school choice policies. I spent a lot of time recently in South Florida, in the greater Fort Lauderdale area, where there is an explosion of microschooling. It's a real hub of education entrepreneurship. And the vast majority of those microschools there are participants in the state's generous tax credit scholarship program that enable education funding to follow students, typically income eligible in Florida, but increasingly in places like Arizona and West Virginia, it's more universal. And families are able to then take advantage of these micro schools tuition free, or again, at a fraction of the cost that they otherwise would be paying for a typical private school. So because this is all in the realm of private education, they're typically, you know, accessible to more families and not kind of falling under the rubric of state oversight.
That's amazing. It's rare that you have such an egalitarian approach where money's not the object. You don't have to be, you know, an elite group. It sounds like everybody can partake of this. I love that. So let's take our first break, because I want to ask about the bigger micro school you just mentioned. It sounds like maybe, I don't know if it's corporate or not, but I'd love to discuss that when we come back. So let's take our first break. You're living in the solution. Welcome back to Living in Solution. We're speaking with Ms. Carrie McDonald. Again, she's a member of the Foundation for Economic Education. And prior to the break, you were giving a wonderful synopsis of how money is not the object anymore. It's about quality. And I love the fact that there's competition now. You know, with the public school system before, there was no competition. Oh, you could do whatever you wanted, and everybody was a captive audience. Everything, innovation comes from choice and from people being able to do what's best for them, and the best will rise to the top. I think that goes with everything. But you mentioned that there were, it sounds like a company or companies that have micro schooling. Can you speak a little bit more about that? Is that a corporate version of this, or is that still entrepreneurial?
Yeah, so that's a great question. So I mentioned that micro schools were gaining traction pre-2020, including some large micro school networks. So I think of, for example, Acton Academy, which is a large micro school network of independently run and operated micro schools that are affiliated with the Acton Academy model. But it's all sort of parent and teacher entrepreneurs who launch these small learning communities, either in their homes or at a local, you know, in a local commercial space. And they began in 2010. They now have about 280 micro schools in more than 30 states and 25 countries. So that's an example of a fast-growing micro school network that's also gained much more popularity over the past couple of years, just as more and more families understand what micro schooling is and want that for their kids. And there's some other micro school networks that also gained traction over the past couple of years, but that started long before that. I think of the Wildflower Montessori micro school network that was started in Massachusetts in 2014. They now have more than 60 micro schools across the country and in Puerto Rico, and they actually have a few cities, including Minneapolis and New York City and Washington, D.C., where they have some charter school partnerships, so tuition free for students there. And they have also experienced a lot of growth over the past couple of years. And then Prenda is another one that I mentioned that was started in 2018 in Arizona. They have now reached roughly 10,000 students in several states, and they continue to grow as well. So there are these networks, but there's also a lot of just independent micro school founders, just entrepreneurial parents and educators who are trying to solve a problem in their own families or their own communities, who then decide to create a micro school to kind of hang up their shingle and realize that a lot of other families were wanting something similar. They wanted that personalized learning. They wanted that mastery-based content. They wanted to be able to have more involvement in their children's education. And they wanted the diversity of options. I mean, I think that's something that's really astounding about today's micro schools, whether they're independent one-off micro schools or they're affiliated with a national network, is there's a tremendous diversity in terms of educational philosophies and approaches. You can choose as a parent now anything from a kind of classical micro school that has, you know, kind of traditional subjects and experiences to more unstructured micro schools, more of the unschooling model, to a Montessori micro school or a Waldorf micro school, or any kind of educational approach and philosophy. And that just gives families so many more options, so much more customization in education the way they have in every other part of their lives, right? Mm-hmm. We have so much personalization and choice in every other consumer decision. And up until recently, we have not had that same experience in education. And so I think the micro school movement is really a testament to the ways in which we can encourage a diversity of options for families so that they can choose the one that best fits their child's needs and their personal preferences. So it's really exciting to see, again, not only the established networks that continue to kind of set the tone and also, you know, provide the framework of success for micro schools, but then see these one-off independent micro schools really take root. And one of the surprising things that I found in kind of covering especially the contemporary micro school movement over the past couple of years is just the sheer number of these micro schools that are being launched by former public school teachers who are just burnt out and tired of working the conventional system for a whole variety of reasons. And they are, you know, launching their own micro schools. I think, for example, of Jill Perez in New Jersey. She was a longtime public school teacher. She had more recently moved into a student teaching supervisor role at a university. When the pandemic hit, she created a pandemic pod with some other families because she wanted her kids to continue to have that kind of social experience and continue learning during the remote learning time. And it was so successful, and so many families were thrilled with what she was doing that they really were seeking more. They wanted something even more formal, more established. So last fall, in the fall of 2021, she opened a micro school in New Jersey with about 45 kids, mixed age. Families could choose either part-time or full-time. They were, you know, recognized homeschoolers. Homeschooling is quite easy to do in New Jersey. There's very few regulations in New Jersey, so it's really easy to kind of have parents take control of their children's education. And she recruited a lot of teachers from the New York City public schools to work in her micro school because they were fed up with what they were seeing in the classroom and wanted something different. You know, I think that's one of the things that we forget a lot of time is that teachers are as caught up in what's happening in public schools as their students are. Their hands are tied. They have to contend with standardization and bureaucracy and all of these constraints. They don't have that ability to be creative anymore. And it's frustrating for many of them. So they're either leaving to launch a micro school on their own or to potentially work at one.
I love that. Now, you've mentioned it was mixed ages. What's the youngest child that enters one of these micro schools?
So they really vary. I mean, you can have some micro schools that are truly reminiscent of the one-room schoolhouse model where you'd have kind of a K-12 micro school. And when we talk about micro schools, it's typically under 50 kids and is intentionally small. So even though these micro schools may be in high demand and a lot of families may want to take advantage of them and the founders realize they have the potential for growth, they want to stay intentionally small, typically under 50 kids, sometimes just a couple of dozen, to again allow for that personalization and individualization of learning. But many of these founders are interested in scaling. They do want to expand, but they want to expand horizontally, laterally, by opening additional small schools, additional micro schools, as opposed to expanding vertically by increasing the size of their existing micro school. So they're really committed to that kind of small mixed age model. And then you'll see some micro schools that, you know, are more for elementary age, but again, mixed age, you might have K-6. Some, for example, one of the ones I visited in South Florida is specifically focused on middle school, has a lot of kind of flexibility around what that is. So they tend to be less rigid than other schools. So if you say you're, you know, focused on middle school, but you had a parent that might have, you know, a fourth grader who would benefit from that, you know, there'd be some flexibility there, even though they may not quite be at the middle school level, and same on the upper end too. And then you have some that would be focused just on middle and high school or just high school. So it's really, again, up to the entrepreneurial founder. What is their expertise? What's their background? What are they seeing as a need in their community? And then they're going off and building that.
Now, from this freedom that people are experiencing, how does that put them back on track when you're talking about testing? Is that something, I know it's people are tested out the wazoo in the standardized school system. How does that work in the micro school system?
So again, because these are private schools, they're very often not subject to standardized tests. Oh. If private schools in certain states are required to participate in standardized tests, then they may be too, although if they're homeschool resource centers or operating like a micro school that could be open 5 days a week, but is you know, their students are primarily homeschoolers, again, it would be up to kind of homeschool law in those states in terms of testing. So they do have a lot of flexibility in that way. And, you know, I do, if South Florida or Florida is a great example where we're seeing, again, this hub of educational entrepreneurship sprouting, many of those micro schools there, as I mentioned, participate in the tax credit scholarship program as part of that accountability. If you decide to participate in the tax credit scholarship program, part of the accountability is that you will take standardized tests, but that accountability falls on the individual student. The accountability is not on whatever school or learning provider or vendor the child, you know, uses, which I think is such a great way of structuring these school choice policies, because that means that the child or the family that is using those public funds, they're the ones who are accountable. They have to you know, show some progress academically or show that they are, you know, meeting certain standards, but it provides this maximum autonomy, flexibility, and ability to experiment for the individual service providers so that they're not required to be standardized in a way that might be similar to a conventional school.
I got you. I mean, I can speak to this personally. I guess I went to a micro school technically. I mean, there were only 13 people in my graduating class and the whole upper school had 50. So I can totally relate to a hands-on, you don't get lost anywhere and you have accountability for learning what you're supposed to learn. From the standpoint of, you know, I guess it's kind of young. So what's the matriculation to college and going to higher education?
Yeah, I mean, I think, again, you know, these are just like private schools. So if they are focusing on high school students. Many of them would be focusing on college prep, or they might be focusing on career prep. I think it's as varied as we see in private schools more broadly, and again, up to the individual education entrepreneur.
Okay, that makes sense.
If we see, you know, homeschooling generally, I mean, a lot of these, as I mentioned, fall under the homeschooling criteria, or the families themselves are recognized as homeschoolers. And of course, we see, you know, peer-reviewed studies that show that homeschoolers outperform their conventionally schooled peers in terms of academics and college placement.
If you're allowed to blossom and not have to be put into a, you know, a square peg in a round hole kind of situation, I'm sure that kids actually do thrive because they're doing something that they actually love. And I think for me, I would wonder, and it's probably just an esoteric question, but the fact that you are an individual in this kind of environment, right? This is not like you're grouped and it's just teach for a test and get them in, get them out. It seems to me like there's a personal touch to this that's just invaluable.
I think that's right. You know, and you'll find, you know, it's interesting. I talk in one of my recent Forbes articles about my experiences in South Florida and some of the micro schools there. One of the founders is Laurel Suarez. I recently had her on my podcast as well to talk about her experience founding a micro school in 2019. So kind of before micro schools took off over the past couple of years. She has about 50 kids in her micro school, typically elementary to middle school ages. And she tests them because she wants to see that they're improving academically. She kind of wants to see where they're coming to her in terms of their abilities, and then where their strengths and weaknesses are and what they need to do to improve. But she was joking that she recently got accredited, and the accrediting agency came in and was asking the students, you know, what do you feel, how do you feel about testing? How do you feel, you know, when you have your assessment? And the student said, oh, no, we don't test. And then Ms. Suarez had to, you know, show them on the computer this program that they occasionally will do which was their testing and assessment platform. And they said, oh, yeah, you can do that from time to time if that's what you mean, but that's no big deal. And they're outperforming their peers in conventional schools. They are, you know, exceeding their expectations from when they come in to, you know, kind of where they are when they leave. So it's just amazing, to your point about this individualization and kind of child-centered learning, what kinds of gains can be made.
It's wonderful. On that note, let's take our second break and come back. You're living in the solution. Welcome back to Living Solution. We're speaking with Ms. Carrie McDonald, and you can go to her podcast, Liberated Podcast. It's LIBERATED podcast. Where can people find it?
Yeah, you can go to liberatedpodcast.com, or you can find it on any of the major podcast platforms or on YouTube.
Now, before the break, we were talking about the academic side. What about the social side? I mean, part of going to school is being socialized in a way. And how do you interact with people who are not like yourself? Or how do you find your place in this world? Because it's so small, is there any, I mean, what makes, I would think it's probably better, but what's your finding on that in terms of socialization, social skills? Because that seems to be a problem these days.
Well, I mean, I have a couple of answers to that. You know, the first is many of the kids who are in these micro schools were in conventional schools and were bullied or had, you know, were exposed to what we would consider negative socialization. They had a really awful time in school and in that experience. And so then coming to this more intimate, personalized learning environment with, you know, educators who can take the time to be with them and get to know them and focus on creating an environment that, you know, of mutual respect and understanding, you know, I think that is a game changer for a lot of those kids. But what you're finding is, especially as there are these clusters of education entrepreneurship that are emerging, as I mentioned, in South Florida, I was also in the Wichita, Kansas area, very different from South Florida, but almost identical in terms of the types of micro schools that are emerging and the popularity of those micro schools. What you find in these areas is a tremendous amount of collaboration among these different micro schools. And again, they might have very different educational viewpoints, ideas and philosophies around education, Some might be secular, some might be faith-based. Again, some might have a classical focus, others might be more progressive. And yet they come together as a community to share resources. They will, you know, get together as kind of micro school communities, maybe even participate in extracurricular activities together. If they have guest speakers, they may invite another micro school around town to come over. And another thing we're finding kind of related to that is that some of these micro schools are really incubating newer micro schools. So I mentioned earlier Laurel Suarez, who was one of the first kind of modern micro school founders in the Fort Lauderdale area. She ended up providing classroom space for additional micro school founders who just needed the location, because getting access to appropriate classroom space is a real challenge for education entrepreneurs. So she was able to rent space out to a couple of different education entrepreneurs who went on to then create their own established micro schools just a few miles away. So it's great to see that kind of community connection, collaboration, not only for the students, but for the entrepreneurs as well.
Now, is there more concentration in urban areas or suburban? What's the demographic of parents who are flocking to this?
Well, I mean, again, it'll depend on different areas. You know, one of the things, I'll go back to Florida because I did a deep dive there. What we find there is that more than half of the micro school founders are people of color, and the student body is majority minority. And that's actually also true more nationally if we think about founder demographics. The Vela Education Fund is a philanthropic nonprofit organization that helps provide micro grants, kind of seed funding for these micro schools and other kinds of non-traditional learning models. And they've done extensive research on their grantees. They started in 2020 and have given over 1,800 micro grants to founders across the country. And they also have majority minority founders. Many of the students who participate in these micro schools are low income. They're either participating through school choice policies that make it more accessible, as I mentioned in Florida, or by the nature of these micro schools and having lower tuition costs, often with generous scholarships and financial aid opportunities, it tends to be more accessible to families that way. I think it's interesting to kind of look at those demographics and see, you know, who is participating. Back to Wichita, there's a micro school there that has about 35 kids, majority neurodiverse. So of the 35 kids, only about 4 would be considered neurotypical, according to the founders. The rest have dyslexia, ADHD, autism, various other kinds of neurodiversity. And those students wouldn't be able to attend, again, according to the founders, if it wasn't for that partnership, that public-private partnership with the Prenda Microschool Network that enables those students to attend tuition-free.
That's amazing. And I remember prior to the microschool phenomenon, that whole charter school and voucher and choice was a real awful, just it seemed very adversarial. People trying to get their children into charter schools. This just seems like somebody just created something else and it just released the pressure on that. Is that what happened?
Well, you know, it's interesting you bring up charter schools, because in the early days of charter schools, kind of in the 1990s and early 2000s, they were very experimental. I mean, they were the education innovation of the time. They were given a lot of freedom and flexibility and latitude. And then over the years, they have become much more standardized and much more controlled and constrained, and moved away from that kind of initial vision of being very innovative and experimental. And I worry about that with the micro school movement as well, particularly, you know, when there are these kind of public-private partnerships that could potentially limit the freedom and flexibility that these founders have. I think that the difference is that most of these micro schools are being founded, by individual entrepreneurs with the intent to be kind of low-cost, accessible private education models, and hopefully that will help them to retain some of that autonomy.
And in terms of the funding, you said that, I mean, Florida is really probably out there in terms of being innovative, but You know, we always wonder if government's giving any money, what strings are attached to it? You know, is this really just parents and teachers running the show, or is there any backdoor strings that are attached so they can control it kind of remotely?
Yeah. I mean, again, Florida is a great model with their tax credit scholarship programs where the accountability lies with the individual students and the families, who then need to show that they've taken standardized tests or may have to show some kind of academic progress. The accountability is not lying with the individual micro school or private school or any other kind of learning provider. And I think that that's, again, the way it should be, because then it provides those founders with that freedom and flexibility to experiment without being constrained. You know, one of the interesting things that I found in Florida was that you had examples of education entrepreneurs who might have created more informal programs, like homeschool programs that maybe met 2 or 3 days a week, or a forest school or an outdoor kind of program. And then they realized that they wanted to, mainly due to parent demand, wanted something that was more full-time, that was more structured, or at least, you know, had a more formal feel to it, that met, again, 5 days a week for families that wanted that. And then they needed a building in order to access the tax credit scholarship, in order to enable their students, I should say, to access the tax credit scholarship. And so many of them kind of moved from that informal 2 or 3 day a week, you know, kind of nomadic lifestyle or experience that they had before into a formal building, just so that their students would be able to attend at little to no cost through the tax credit scholarship program. And then as part of being an approved vendor, you know, they would need to comply with various health and safety codes and so on. But it doesn't impact the kind of pedagogical or educational philosophy or approach of these micro schools or private schools more broadly.
No, it really also, I would think, opens up the family so that the parents don't have to stay home from school, from work, to take care. I mean, I can't imagine what that was like before this formalized education system, where parents had to stay home if their kids weren't in school. A lot of people lost money and maybe lost their jobs accordingly. This actually fixes that problem. These children, right, are in a structured environment, the parents can go to work, and the family, you know, it just has a much more stable, economically stable framework. Is that one way to see it?
I think that's right. And, you know, I mean, homeschoolers, if we're thinking about kind of, again, this as being a potential version of homeschooling, homeschoolers have long been connected, right? I mean, they've had co-ops, or they've had various hybrid homeschool programs that date back to the early to mid 1990s, where their children would attend kind of an offsite location a couple of days a week, and then do the rest of their curriculum at home. So some of this is not new, and families have recognized the benefit of having these kind of offsite education and care for a while. I think also some of the micro schools that I wrote about in my unschooled book, and the book came out in 2019. So again, before micro schools really took off in popularity, and even some of those micro schools dated back to the mid 1990s, and, you know, had offerings of 4 to 5 days a week where families could, again, drop their kids off. But they were registered homeschoolers, yet they would be able to take advantage of outside educators and curriculum resources, and yet parents were still very much guiding their education, very, very involved, really working partnership with these micro schools and these educators, which is really the way it should be, right?
Oh, absolutely. It's a partnership, just like in healthcare. You should be a partner with your physician or your nurse, you know, whoever the medical personnel is, and it's collegial. And that's how the child feels comfortable. I mean, one thing I remember about school, it was like the structure that made it safe and it made it easy to learn. It seems that this is the same makeup, really, when you think about it.
It's so true. And I think here's an interesting story that your listeners might find intriguing. Is one of my recent podcast guests, again, two former public school teachers in the small town of Byram, Mississippi, outside of Jackson. They couldn't find an educational environment that would work for their children. So they had been in public schools as teachers and then as teacher coaches and consultants to school districts, and yet they still couldn't find what they felt was the best educational fit for their children. They each had daughters who were not finding a good kind of academic environment in either public or private schools. And so they realized they had to build it. And so then they opened their micro school just this past August. And one of the teacher founders said to me on the podcast, she said, my daughter had severe anxiety and ADHD, and she was taking medications for both. And now been at this school 3 or 4 months, is off the ADHD medicine, is off the anxiety medicine because of that personalized, nurturing environment. And it's just miraculous what some of these founders have been able to create.
I love that. And that really is no child left behind, not just the euphemism, but the actual putting it into practice. There's nothing more positive than that. On that note, let's take our last break and come back. You're living in the solution. Welcome back to Living Solution. We're speaking with Ms. Carrie McDonald. And can people go to your website, fee.org? That's the main website for the Foundation for Economic Education. Is that correct?
Yes, you can go to fee.org, fee.org/Carrie. And you can find my social media links there. You can find a link to my podcast, sign up for my weekly newsletter, and see all my articles.
Excellent. Now, we talked about a lot of the positives of this. I think every state should have this. So let's say you're in a state that doesn't have this structure. How can people start the process, teachers, parents? How can they get this rolling if they don't have access to this in their state?
Well, I will say micro schools are everywhere. I have yet to find a state that does not have these in some fashion. They may not be widely known, not sort of well advertised in some places, but they truly are everywhere. As I mentioned, the Baylor Education Fund funding more than 1,800 of these across the country. So often if families, you know, might be surprised at what is available to them, some of these micro schools evolved from pandemic pods, from these small learning communities that existed during COVID. Some were here before COVID during, as part of homeschool resource centers or learning centers. So connecting with local homeschool communities, Facebook groups can sometimes expose what's around to families who may not otherwise be aware of it. And sometimes just Googling microschooling and someone's city or state, you know, they might be surprised what they'll find there. I think if you can't find it, build it, right? That's what's so great about the increase in the number of micro schools in recent years is that families said, you know, I can't find what I'm looking for. Teachers said, I can't find what I'm looking for. I'm going to have to go build it. Interestingly, another educator in Mississippi, where I was recently, in kind of the rural part of the state, up in Pontotoc, Mississippi, where there's very few private schools overall and no micro schools, she had been the founder, Donna Aker. She had been a public school teacher for almost 30 years and was ready to retire, was kind of getting tired of what she was seeing in conventional schools. And then said, well, you know, I'm not sure I'm ready to get out of education. You know, I just feel like I might want to do things differently. I might just be a bit burned out from the conventional system. And so she went ahead and created an Aspen Academy affiliate in Pontotoc, Mississippi. And she has families who drive an hour and a half each way to come to her micro school because there is nothing else like it, because she is offering such a tremendous service. And she's another example of a school that's really at full capacity after only being open a couple of years, and she's looking to expand again laterally by opening additional schools, you know, in her area and kind of the wider northern Mississippi geographic area. So there is a lot of demand for this, and I think the more educators realize that they can actually create something meaningful that parents will really be excited about and clamor for, I think it can just encourage more and more educators to go off on their own and build something.
Now, of the micro schools that you've studied and know about, are there any specialty ones, like for science-based or for art-based? Is there any specialty within the system?
Yeah, that's a great question. I mean, some, again, will have sort of a specific focus, whether it's a classical microschool or a Montessori microschool or self-directed learning or unschooling. I mentioned the microschool in Wichita, Kansas, that focuses on neurodiverse children. There's also other microschools that do also focus on neurodiversity and special needs. So I think there's just something for everybody. And that's, again, where it just is a matter of the ingenuity of the entrepreneurial educator who's building this, what they're interested in, what they think their community would gravitate to. But there's really something for everybody, which goes back to kind of the earlier point of this diversification of education and the expansion of options so that families can really find something that reflects their needs and preferences.
And from the teachers that have opened their own, is there any kind of resource for any teacher to they don't know this existed, so they can go somewhere and there's a clearinghouse or someplace that they can learn and move towards being an entrepreneur? Because that it is a skill.
Yeah. There's not a central clearinghouse. I think that's probably more of a feature than a bug, right? I mean, it's great that this is decentralized, that it's individuals kind of finding their way. But there are increasingly support structures. So if they're interested in, if an entrepreneurial parent or educator is interested in launching a microschool, they could start by looking at some of the established networks like Prenda, like Wildflower Montessori, like Action Academy. There's also Liberated Learners, which is more unschooly, self-directed learning approach. So start there just to get a sense of what might be available and then move on. There's also another newer microschool network called KiPod Learning that launched last year in the summer of 2021. It's a Boston-based microschool network that actually, you know, participated in the prestigious Y Combinator Silicon Valley Startup Accelerator Program. What I really love about KiPod is that it's sort of the best of the personalization of online learning within an in-person social structure. So families are typically registered homeschoolers or they could be enrolled in a virtual school, but it's the parents that decide what curriculum the child is learning. They have full autonomy as parents over what their children are learning. Again, it could be faith-based, it could be secular, it could have all kinds of different flavors of educational philosophies and approaches. And then they come together as mixed-age students into a physical location in a commercial space with a hired educator to learn together and get help from the experienced educator. If they get stuck, the educator also plans enrichment activities and social opportunities. And I think that's one of the best models I've seen out there, where it has, again, that maximum flexibility for parents, maximum parent autonomy within that in-person social structure with adult educators facilitating the pods. And so that is a network that's also helping interested educators who want to create their own microschool, their own community to affiliate with them. So there are these national networks, but there are, again, also lots of opportunities for people who want to go it alone and just being able to connect with other microschools in one's community in the kind of greater geographic area. They might be surprised to see that there's more out there than they may think, and they can build some community there.
And in terms of the children, you've described a lot of collegiality, really, that you can mix and match and meet with each other. But is there any difference when they meet a child going to a standardized school, a standard education? What's their interaction with each other? Because it's completely different access to education. The mindset's different. Do they get along? I mean, it's kind of an interesting question, but they're so different. How do they interact?
So true. If I'm hearing you correctly, I mean, I think it's interesting when we think about conventional schooling, right? It's, tends to be age segregated. So it's not the mixed age environment that we see in micro schools and some of these other innovative models. It tends to be very top down as opposed to more of a personalized learner centered curriculum. It tends to be, you know, kind of very command and control and not very nurturing. Again, the way that these microschools are. So I think there's so many more benefits to more personalized learning and these smaller learning communities. That was one of the things I think we realized from COVID is Small is powerful, right? Like having these smaller spaces, especially when you can collaborate, you know, kind of across micro schools and within your larger communities, can be a really effective way of educating children.
You know, I'm just, this is the future of education, right? To me, just like from a healthcare perspective, it's the patient who wants to take the power back on their health and become partner with their doctor. That's the future of healthcare. I mean, in your opinion, well, I think I know the answer, but if education could just be, just go out to the individual instead of being from top down, the Department of Education and all their mandates, et cetera, do you think that that would make a huge difference in, because overall, our I don't think we score very well, really, compared to other countries. Would this help make us more equal, would improve our baseline, our standard of education, if this was became the norm, as opposed to just people who are ready to run their own show?
Yeah, I mean, I just think that more and more parents and educators are tired of a kind of cookie cutter, one size fits all, standardized education model that really hasn't changed much in well over a century. You know, they recognize that we have so much innovation and choice and opportunity in other parts of our lives, but education is typically stuck in this sort of dinosaur model. And micro schools are one way of modernizing education. And, you know, the micro school founders I talk to say that they absolutely believe this is the future of education. And many of them, as I mentioned, are former public school teachers who've seen both sides, and they are convinced that this is the future of education, that smaller, more personalized learning communities are much higher quality, really are what parents are looking for and what learners need. And when leveraging the tools of technology to enable students to access, you know, world-class educators and world-class content, it makes these learning communities even more beneficial. So there's no doubt in my mind, in the minds of the micro school founders that I speak with and visit, that this is absolutely the future of education, and that it will continue to apply competitive pressure on conventional schools to adapt, or they will continue to lose students. I mean, that's really the kind of statistics that go along with this, is that since 2020, there's some estimates that suggest that 7 million students have left district schools. Many of them are going to private schools or to charter schools or to homeschooling. Again, estimates of more than 2 million students now being microschooled full-time. That's their full-time learning experiences as a microschooler. So I think we're really just at the beginning, at the tip of the iceberg when it comes to the ways in which microschooling will transform education.
I love that. You know, time goes way too quickly, but I want to make sure people know how to listen to your podcast and read what you write on the FEE.org website.
Thanks again, Dr. George. Yeah, so it's liberatedpodcast.com, or you can find Liberated Podcast in any major podcast platform. And you can find me again at fee.org/Kerry, K-E-R-R-Y. And you can also read my column at Forbes.
Ms. McDonald, I love what you do. Thanks for everything and keep up the good work.
Oh, thanks, Dr. George. Great to be with you.
Thank you. And thank you, everybody, for living in the solution.
Revolutionary talk for revolutionary times. Liberty Talk FM.